From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Kentucky, where a young teacher seemed to have everything going for her. Jessica Duenas was the first in her immigrant family to go to college. In 2019, she won a statewide teaching award. But Duenas told NPR that through this time, she was leading a double life. The year that she won her award, she says she was typically drinking nearly a liter of liquor every night. She says she couldn't keep food down. Her stomach hurt to the touch, and her eyes were starting to get yellowish. She was 34 years old, and Duenas was diagnosed with alcoholic hepatitis, a type of alcoholic liver disease. Her doctor said that unless she did not stop drinking, and quickly, she could cause extreme damage to her liver or die. Duenas shared her story for a recent NPR report about the sharp rise in alcoholic liver disease among young women in particular. A JAMA study found that 41% of women drank more in 2020 than they did in 2019. Survival rates for alcoholic hepatitis and cirrhosis can be very low. So what's causing the increase in cases? Well, experts say pandemic stressors have led to a rise in drinking, and pop culture has validated drinking as a coping mechanism. And not just drinking, heavy drinking as a coping mechanism. This hour, we talk about the rise in the disease, the psychological components tied to it, and what experts say can help people experiencing these challenges. Our guests include Dr. Marie Laria, who is an associate professor in the Department of Medicine, Gastroenterology and Hepatology, the Department of Surgery and Transplant, and the Associate Chair of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in the Department of Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Laria, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Myra Mathis is with us, a senior instructor in the Department of Psychiatry and Addiction Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Mathis, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me as well.
And welcome to Sean Yance, the certified peer recovery advocate and certified addictions recovery coach who also has his own experience to share. Hi, Sean. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Laria, let me start with you. In the last year, how much has changed?
You know, I think what we've seen in the hospital and in our clinics is a really sharp rise in patients suffering from alcohol-related liver disease. Alcohol-related liver disease is different than alcoholism. So people who are alcoholics may not have liver disease, and people who have liver disease from alcohol may not be alcoholics. But the presentation of liver disease related to alcohol is definitely skyrocketing. And as you know, as your vignette showed, it's definitely in young women and in young men as well. And presumably related to the stressors of the pandemic. And, you know, this illness is a spectrum. It starts from benign disease that you can detect mostly on blood work and imaging, but all the way to people being very, very sick and needing to come into the hospital. And we've seen an increase in all of the different manifestations of this disease.
And to make sure that we understand the different types here, I have read that there are three types of liver disease related to alcohol consumption: fatty liver, alcoholic hepatitis, or cirrhosis. Is that correct?
Yes, I mean, exactly. It's not something that you can necessarily cut with a knife. There's a spectrum there, and then there's some overlap. But the fatty liver disease is the benign kind that tends to present after, it can happen to anyone after a very heavy night. It's a college student presentation. And the alcoholic hepatitis is much more of a painful presentation. So they have abdominal pain, they have jaundice, they have symptoms of liver disease, and sometimes they're mistaken for a gallbladder attack, and that's more of the way I explain it to patients is the red, hot, swollen, chemically burnt liver that causes that presentation. And then, you know, with chronic alcohol use, you can develop a condition called cirrhosis of the liver, which is a permanent scarring of the liver where the liver goes from being kind of smooth like a frog to lumpy and bumpy like a toad. And the liver eventually, because it's dependent on its smoothness to work properly, this lumpy, bumpy appearance eventually can lead to liver failure and even liver cancer as well. So there's a spectrum there where some people can have a combination of things. They could have a little bit of alcoholic hepatitis on top of their cirrhosis. But as a general rule, those are the three presentations that we see in patients with liver alcohol-related liver disease.
And I want to, Doctor, I want to be as clear as we can about what tends to cause it, because I'm sure some listeners are thinking, well, I have a drink at night with dinner. I have a glass of wine or two a night. I might have a cocktail or a beer with dinner. Usually not more than that. I know every person is different. Typically speaking, if a person is having a glass of wine, maybe a glass or two of wine with dinner, but not drinking to excess, are they in line for one of these diseases?
Yeah, so that's a phenomenal question and something that's really important to clarify. And the first thing is that everybody's definition of a glass of wine with dinner will be different. So it's important when we talk about alcohol, when we talk to our patients as doctors, that we really clarify how much in real terms, because it's very different. So if you're talking about a 5-ounce alcohol, glass of wine, so that's called 1 alcohol unit. And usually we say for women, the safe amount of alcohol is less than 2 alcohol units a day. So from 2 to 4 alcohol units we think can be associated with alcohol-related liver disease. And for men, we say it's 5 to 7. So they have a little bit more of a tolerance there. The key, though, is something that you said, which is some people are sensitive to alcohol from a liver perspective and some aren't. And so there are people who can drink way more than that and will never run into trouble with liver disease. And then there are people who can't get away with 1 or 2 glasses of wine a day, either because of their genetics or because of they have other conditions that might be accelerating damage to the liver or something like that. So it's a little bit like smoking. You know, everybody will have a story of a grandfather who died at 96 after smoking 3 packs a day. But then again, there are 40-year-olds who get lung cancer. And unfortunately, scientifically, we don't have a great tool. There's no blood test I can give to people to say your liver can take that amount of alcohol or not. You know, as liver doctors, we say the safest amount of alcohol is no alcohol at all. And, you know, sometimes the only thing we can do is once people present with some evidence of injury, hopefully in the mild stage, then we can instruct them from there and say, you know what, your liver's telling me that however much you're drinking, that's too much for you. So I think there's a personal component there that makes it more challenging. It would be so much easier if you could simply say, this is how much everybody can drink, and this is safe. And you know, there's been a lot in the media and in reports about how drinking alcohol is good for you. Well, that's true if you have a liver that's not damaged from another condition, or you don't have a genetic predisposition to liver disease. But it's not true if you do. And so it's very important to keep that in mind, that when it comes to safe alcohol levels, it's a discussion that you may want to have with your doctor about what's the risk and what's safe, and to try to keep yourself educated.
Yeah, and is it a case, doctor, where you could say, look, just because having a glass or two of wine with dinner, and to your point, a unit of wine, 5 ounces,
right,
not eight, mm-hmm, not a huge pour of a high alcohol wine, but sort of a glass in that way, even if that's not likely, as long as you're not drinking to excess, to cause one of these diseases, you're not going to be able to offer the guarantee that it couldn't happen.
That's exactly right. I feel like the only thing that, as a liver doctor, I can say is that no alcohol is the safest amount. Everybody else, you know, the science tells us that for women, below 2 units of alcohol a day, you should be okay. But there are personal factors that could change that. So, you know, if you are drinking regularly, you want to be open with your physicians about that. You want to make sure that you are getting in for your checkups. And you want to have that conversation with your doctor to say, well, do you think this is good for me? Do you think it's okay? Or should I be cutting down? Should I be cutting back? You know, I think as a general rule, daily drinking is something that I discourage, in my surroundings, you know, amongst my friends and my family. I tend to discourage daily drinking simply because there is that question mark. And we're generous pourers. We don't really keep track of how much we drink. And you know, I think if in an ideal world, people would not be drinking on a daily basis.
And the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism defines heavy drinking for women as more than 3 drinks in a single day, more than 7 drinks in a week. And is that something that we have enough data to say, yep, that's a problem, that both anecdotally and research from various institutions tells us that at least at this snapshot moment in time, Dr. Laria, that women in particular are doing more of that?
I think that's correct. I think, you know, the culture is very different when it comes to drinking in women. Before, it was not acceptable to see a woman drink on camera or drink a beer from a bottle, or, you know, there were certain things that were taboo. But if you look at TV now, like I was just watching a series on Netflix the other day, and there's constant, you know, drinking sometimes in some TV shows, and women drink hard liquor. It's much more acceptable. So there's a societal message about, you know, about what's acceptable. But then also there's there's a cultural approach to alcohol that's, you know, we're going through extremely stressful times, and you know, women are under a lot of stress. There's the stress from motherhood, from working outside the home, you know, from being caregivers in the middle of a pandemic. And there is the notion of kind of the mommy juice, right? The crutch, that the way to relax after a long and difficult day. So some of the cultural and some of the values around alcohol have changed. And unfortunately, that's led to some people who are more susceptible to alcohol probably drinking more than they would have in the past, and therefore coming to grips with the impact of alcohol on their health. And it goes beyond the liver. We focus a lot on the liver, but, you know, the alcohol is also considered a cancer-causing agent. It has also, you know, it's a nerve toxin, and there's evidence that it causes cognitive decline and all sorts of things. So it's beyond just what it does to your liver. I think it is something that we enjoy and that we like to do with friends, but it's something that does cost us on a health level, and we should be factoring that into our decisions.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about this cultural shift that maybe we've seen in recent years, or maybe even in the last couple of decades. So as I get older, and I'd like to still convince myself I'm pretty young, but as I get older, I prefer wines that are lower alcohol. I like to make cocktails occasionally, but I prefer lower alcohol, lighter cocktails. I just don't really like drinking heavy stuff. And that sort of slows me down or hits me the next day. And I'm not talking about drinking excess. I mean, even one drink or one glass of wine, I feel differently if it's lower alcohol compared to, you know, 13, 14%. And and my feeling, Dr. Laria, is that when we look at pop culture, you know, we hear people say, boy, I really need a drink, or boy, it's been a long day, I could use a drink. I mean, I've said that myself. But often I think what modern pop culture sort of frames this as is, I need to get drunk. Not I need a drink, but like I need to go out and cut it loose and drink to excess. That seems to be the shift, whether people sort of intend to mean that or not. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I do agree that there is that notion, although we can all identify that kind of drinking as problematic, right? So it's something that in our own values, we know if I'm getting sloshed 3 times a week, that's probably problematic. But however, it's the more problematic drinking, and I think the more difficult values that are instilled is more the kind of, oh, I'm just going to unwind, it's going to be fantastic, I'm going to open a bottle of wine, I'm going to sip it, or I'm really into wine and I'm buying fancy wine, I'm drinking fancy wine out of a crystal glass. And kind of that ritualization of alcohol and that delight that we take into it, which isn't evil. It's not an evil thing. But just as a health provider, it does lead to overconsumption, right? If you're alone or if you're two people, you open a bottle of wine, you share it, you finish it. If you're a woman, you're at risk for, you know, that's too much alcohol for you. If you're a man, you're probably flirting with the line. And so I think that's what's, to me, when I look at kind of the pop culture out there, to me, that's the new message. That's the new thing of the, it's appropriate for moms and mom groups to talk about going home and having a glass of wine and unwinding, and this is what I do, and is it too early to start drinking? It must be 5 o'clock somewhere. As opposed to kind of the classic, let's go to a bar and let's just have a great Saturday night and let's blow off some steam, which I think has always been part of our, you know, part of the cultural background.
Yeah, it's just a question of how much. And I want to turn to our other guests on some of this, because I think there are a lot of different threads here as we talk about alcohol usage, liver disease related to that, and what's especially been happening in the last year. I mean, listeners might have heard the NPR reporting focusing on women who, I mean, let's be honest, women have borne the brunt as NPR noted, of many of the pressures of pandemic life. Women in disproportionate numbers have lost jobs. I mean, millions of Americans lost jobs in the pandemic, women in much higher proportions. That's a huge problem. Women, more than men, and I'm not speaking monolithically, but just on average, are dealing with childcare more, kids who had to be home more, schooling issues more. And so, you know, if you hear mommy juice, rosé all day, wind down Wednesday, Zoom happy hours, I'm not sort of denigrating the fun that could be if you do it like within reason. I'm not trying to say like don't ever do it or that's bad. And frankly, I'm trying to understand all the cultural reasons that we're here for this. Mm-hmm. But clearly, there has been a disproportionate focus of the pandemic stress on women. And Dr. Myra Mathis, can I ask you about this? I mean, what have you seen in the last year in relation to that?
Yeah, thanks, Evan, for the question. It is true, as we're thinking about the stressors of the pandemic, and often this includes other increase in other stress-related diseases, right? So as an addiction psychiatrist, I'm thinking about the overall mental health toll, anxiety, depression increasing during the pandemic as a result of the variety of stressors that you mentioned. But that also can include increase in substance use, and that can turn into increase in unhealthy substance use. And we see this across all substance use disorders and not just alcohol use, but in particular with alcohol use because of its easy access and some of the cultural factors that you mentioned. It is normalized to have a glass of wine at the end of the day to relax. There is easy access to wine in terms of it being available at the liquor store that's right next door to your grocery store, things like that. So the accessibility, the increase in stressors, all leads folks to trying to figure out how to cope. And there can be a healthy way of consuming alcohol that is an appropriate coping mechanism, but that can lead to risk. And that risk can cause the amount of consumption to become unhealthy.
And what have you found to be, I mean, I guess I was going to ask you about coping. Every person is different. But is there an approach that has been effective, especially with these problems, particular to the last year, Doctor?
In terms of coping mechanisms specifically? So that's a great question. So how do we cope during the pandemic? And I think that's a question that many have been asking throughout the last year and a half. And certainly the other aspects of coping that we would normally turn to in terms of gathering with friends and family, those kinds of things are not happening. And so things like a Zoom happy hour do tend to be a way of coping. Can you utilize Zoom without the happy hour part? Of course. Thinking about incorporating other mental health tools for healthy coping, mindfulness practices, et cetera, those things can definitely be useful during these times of increased stress. But often those aren't as easily accessible, right? Sure, we can download the Calm app and we can have a guided meditation, but that might not be advertised as much as the Wind Down Wednesday or the Zoom happy hour for sure.
Well, and I want to ask Sean about his personal story. Sean's a certified peer recovery advocate and a certified addictions recovery coach. We're going to do that in just a second, and I want to open it up to some listener feedback because I think Sean's story will be instructive, especially on the medical side, understanding these conditions, these diseases, understanding what treatment looks like. We're going to talk about treatment, and I want to open it up as well to questions from listeners to better understand this. So 844-295-TALK, it's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program. It's connections@WXXI.org. And Sean, you know, you're someone who is suffering from non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, is that right?
Yeah, I actually Dr. Larry was the one who I saw a couple months ago, and she diagnosed me with that and NASH. But those had come out of or had been found through the fact that I'd had alcohol-induced hepatitis and cirrhosis of the liver. So
tell me about your story that led to that. You know, your sort of your past behavior and what you've changed and where you are now. Take me through that.
Well, so I spent about 20 years working in the service industry, including running bars, restaurants, and wineries. And in that time, I was running beverage programs. And part of the culture is, you know, lots of partying and, you know, drinking and whatnot. So I obviously partook in that. And about last January, it's not this one that just passed, the one before, 2020, I had returned from a trip to my brother's place in Philadelphia, and my family came over and told me that I was yellow and jaundiced. So they took me to the hospital, and that's when we discovered all the liver problems I was having. I had a bilirubin count of over 12, which I believe the typical is, the doctors could correct me if I'm wrong here, but around one or under, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. Jaundice and having liver failure at that time. So I started my trip on recovery. And
Hold on, Sean. How did that hit you, learning that stuff?
It was pretty heavy. You know, I kind of went along the whole time thinking, you know, nothing's wrong with me at this point, so what's it matter? You know what I mean? I knew I was drinking too much, but at the same time, I was kind of in that ambivalent mode of just, why do I need to change anything, you know, if it's not really affecting me? And so that was the first heavy dose of reality I got at that time. So, yeah, it was a needed shock to the system.
Okay, and so take me through then the steps that followed for you.
So I started doing outpatient at Park Ridge, and I was doing great for a few months there. And I was still actually running the winery tasting room at the time. So this was, and bartending on the side, so dangerous grounds. But I actually was strong until about April, so after the pandemic hit. And then I started... I relapsed a little bit and slipped here and there, and eventually ended up in the hospital with I can't remember the term right now. Internal bleeding from the esophagus. Esophageal varices. There we go. And with that, though, they found more liver problems in that my liver functions weren't leveling out. So I was hospitalized twice in May of last year. For esophageal varices and internal bleeding. And actually today marks a year from the day that I went into inpatient at Clifton Springs and decided to make sure that I wasn't going to go back down that road. So
how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm great. I honestly haven't been over a year since I've partaken in anything, and I feel awesome. You know, I mean, I actually, when I got out of inpatient, I realized that I wanted to help people in the same way that I was helped. And they recommended, while I was in there, a couple of my counselors did, to look into the SERPA and CARC program. So that's where I ended up. I ended up taking a bunch of courses through Recovery Coach University and started taking classes at MCC as well. And now I work in Ithaca and help other people. So, yeah, I'm doing great, except for the whole liver thing.
Do you feel comfortable with the adjustments you've had to make in your own life to deal with this?
I do. As when it comes to... the diagnosis for the liver became more serious when I got like the NASH diagnosis. I had a MELD score, which the doctors could probably explain better, of 8 to 10 years essentially, and that was how long my liver would function. And that's when I got in touch with Strong and URMC and ended up with Dr. Laria, and they gave me a little bit more time. So it's like about 15 years now. But the nice thing is I with diet, exercise, and staying sober, I can hopefully reverse or at least tackle some of these problems, you know.
Dr. Lario, what's the long-term prognosis for someone like Sean?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm so glad to hear, Sean, that you're doing well.
Yeah, thanks.
You know, I think Sean's story really illustrates the spectrum of the disease, which is, you know, when they first present, when somebody like Sean first presents and is extremely sick, you know, that's a really, really life-threatening condition. And about 25 to 45% of patients will die in the first month of severe alcoholic hepatitis. So Sean really dodged a bullet there. And then once that kind of red, hot, swollen component of the liver disease settles down, then you know what's left behind. So initially, a liver can look really, really sick, but some of that liver is in shock just from the irritation. And then as time goes on, that shocked liver kind of turns back around and starts to work again. And it takes about 6 months. Within the first 6 months is when you see the maximal amount of recovery that the liver can do. And at the end of those 6 months, some patients, like Sean, will go back to a liver that fundamentally is fully functional. So it's lost its good looks. It's still lumpy and bumpy, but the motor of the liver is still healthy. And that's what we call compensated cirrhosis. And in cases when there's pure alcohol-related liver disease and there's nothing else, then that liver tends not to get worse from there. However good it gets, it stays there, and it can be that good for decades. Unfortunately, there are some patients that, you know, after that six-month period still have liver failure. And in those cases, you have to think of the next step, which would be something like a liver transplant. But, you know, the when they've looked at patients who have had severe alcoholic hepatitis, you know, the most of the mortality happens right at the beginning, but there is a drop in survival over the next 5 years as well. So we know that those patients, just from, you know, having been so sick, do take a hit on a health level. But if you get beyond those 6 months and you're back compensated, then your prognosis is actually excellent. And it's just unfortunate that for some people, by the time they get to us, they're beyond the point where the liver can recover, and they maintain some degree of liver failure, which I think Sean can tell you is absolute misery.
Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
Oh, I was just going to say, I still experience a lot of the lethargy and other, you know, common symptoms from the liver damage. And it's just a matter now of me trying to maintain and control it at the same time, you know, to get over these things. So,
yeah. In a moment, I'm going to take phone calls from Leslie and Robert who want to weigh in on this. But just briefly, Sean, can you make sure that our listeners understand the difference? You know, you've talked about NASH, or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and some listeners might think, but based on your story, are you describing alcoholism and liver cirrhosis based on alcoholism? So can you offer a little distinction?
Okay, well, I'm working with both here. I have the cirrhosis and damage from my my alcohol use in the past, but coming out of that, we found after the time period when my levels should have been getting better and whatnot, the doctors found that I had non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is a metabolic dysfunction with excessive fat buildup in the liver. And that you can have fatty liver disease also from induced by alcohol. And then NASH is a non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. So it's basically the same thing, but it's more of a genetic disease, if I'm 100% correct here. I'm not sure if they're doctors, but yeah.
It's not genetic, but it's not caused by an environmental toxin or alcohol. So it's more it's kind of part and parcel of the metabolic syndrome, which is obesity, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and insulin resistance or diabetes. And so it's more of, I always say it's a little bit like diabetes of the liver, but under the microscope, they look very similar. And so you have to kind of get rid of the alcohol first to know, and lots of patients do end up having a mix of the two. But you, while you're drinking a significant amount of alcohol, the label is going to be alcohol related until that alcohol is out of your system and your liver should have recovered and there should be no fat left. And then we see that there's still fat and liver damage ongoing. And then that's when we know that there's probably a second condition there.
Sean Yon's telling his story, and great information this hour from Drs. Marie Laria and Dr. Myra Mathis. Let's take this only break and come back to phone. Come right back to the feedback on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, we welcome a researcher who believes he's come up with a way to predict whether our relationships are going to fail or succeed, whether marriages will end up successful or in divorce. Do we really want that? Do we want AI to predict whether we should even date someone? Are human beings static, or can we change? The future of love and dating, Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, Leslie in Rochester. Go ahead, Leslie.
Hi, this is Leslie. And I just have a question. As you guys were talking earlier, prior to the medical piece, you were talking about a cultural piece.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, we have multitudes of cultures around the world. You know, you look at the Italians and Spaniards and Argentinians and the French and their consumption of wine. And I'm wondering if there's data comparison in this time period to just sort of do some comparison and order perhaps for us to figure out our own culture and understand it a little bit better, not just during, the pandemic, but in general.
Yeah, so the challenge, Leslie, is getting really fresh looks at comparative data. The latest I've got is 2019. So if you look at 2019 data, the United States is the number 15 wine-consuming country in the world per capita, well behind, this is per capita, not just sheer bottles, well behind number one, which is Portugal, interestingly enough, then Italy, then France, and then Switzerland. United States number 15, China number 20. That's wine consumption in the year before the pandemic. And when you look at just total alcohol consumption from American Addiction Centers, Belarus is the largest alcohol-consuming country in the year, 14.4 liters per person per year. That's 1.5 times what Americans drink. And a lot of it is harder alcohols, it's true. What I don't know, Leslie, is exactly how that has changed. Dr. Mathis, Dr. Larry, I don't know if you've seen anything updated. Dr. Mathis, do you have any updated idea there? I don't have it in front of me.
Thanks for your question. Actually, I do not have any updates. The data that you referenced is what I currently have available. Although I do think it would be interesting to see, particularly given those countries who have had more difficulty with the pandemic in terms of the loss of life and the grief associated with that, whether or not they've also seen increase in alcohol use as we have seen correlating with other mental health conditions.
So, for example, if we see a rise in depression, do we typically not, again, every person's different, but generally speaking, is there a rise in alcohol usage that goes with that, Dr. Mathis?
So not all the time. It includes a confluence of social factors. So if we're thinking about, let's say, the economic decline that has happened over the last couple of decades even, and using a parallel with the opioid epidemic as we thought about areas that were economically devastated and then had sharp rises in opioid-related deaths in the early 2000s. And now we're seeing that spread to other communities who are also experiencing significant economic decline. Those sorts of factors can then contribute both to depression and anxiety, as well as increase in substance use disorders as a coping mechanism.
Okay. Yeah, Leslie, I hope that helps. And I can tell you, just when you look at liquor sales in the first 6 months of the pandemic in this country were just about every month, it was like a holiday season. It was very high. And, you know, things seemed to just, again, at least anecdotally, and I think from some of the data I've seen, leveled off a little bit. But there's no doubt that Americans consumed more alcohol in the last year. I just don't know how that compares to some other countries. And Robert, next on the phone. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. There's a lot of public policy things that are really kind of running in opposite directions here. First off, you have New York State that's actually providing grants for new craft brewers of up to $3 million per brewery. So, you know, why is the state of New York actually giving money away to create more places where you can buy and consume alcohol? It just seems contradictory. The other thing is, let's put some numbers on this. What is the diagnosis of this premature liver disease cost? You know, what's the bottom line? Put a number on that and let's see how much that costs taxpayers, because ultimately a lot of this does filter down to medical costs borne by everyone.
Yeah, Robert, thank you. So there's a couple points that he's bringing up here. I'm going to try to dig it. I think I've got in the numbers here. Yep, in the United States, more than 44,000 people died of alcoholic liver disease in 2019. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has not yet compiled data on any overall increase in hospitalizations from alcoholic liver disease since the pandemic began. But Dr. Jessica Mellinger, a liver specialist at the University of Michigan, told NPR, quote, "In my conversations with colleagues at other institutions, everyone is saying the same thing. It's astronomical. It's gone off the charts." So it's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of people. And yes, there's a healthcare cost. On the subject of giving a grant to a brewery, we know that sugar is a problem. Sugar can cause inflammation. Sugar is a big problem for weight gain and all kinds of other things that lead to some other health complications. We probably all should have less sugar. And Robert, definitely New York State and just about every government in the world has probably offered grants to new companies that make sugary products. So you could do this all day with things that, with the kinds of products that we eat or drink that can cause us harm. I don't necessarily want to be in a society where we've got no right to eat anything but kale. I like kale, kale and water. But I think what our guests are telling us is understand the risks here and be careful. And, you know, Dr. Larry, I'm going to give you the floor again. I mean, in your view, you know, I think education, information can be powerful for us to help guide our choices here. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think alcohol is part of the human experience. It's something that's been with us, you know, as far as we can go back in the archaeological record, right? So this is something that's part of us, of our culture, and of every culture around the world. There appears to be some history of alcohol. I think it's for everybody individually to decide, you know, in terms of the moral and the value side of alcohol. I think, as a physician, I steer clear of that. I don't judge my patients. I understand that, you know, when they come to me, they're sick and they're vulnerable, and they behaved in a way that was, in line with what they thought was their reality. If they had known they had liver disease, they probably would have stopped. So I think I don't judge anyone that wants to have a drink, that enjoys it, and I fully understand it. I think what's the key is that it's a little bit like diving. If you enjoy diving, you have to know that sometimes you can't, there are shallow pools in which you cannot dive. And you have to understand the risk of, if you do dive in that shallow pool, what can happen. And so it's the same thing with alcohol. It's understanding that what would put me at risk for liver disease related to alcohol, and what do I need to do in terms of my alcohol consumption to make sure that I don't put myself at risk. But I think that's what I'm trying to convey to your listeners, is that that's a conversation to have with your healthcare provider or with yourself about, you know, am I putting myself at extra risk? If I have hepatitis C already, well, maybe there's no amount of alcohol that I should be drinking right now until my virus is cleared. If I'm taking certain medications that are hard on the liver, should I be mixing that with alcohol? There is a certain level of individuality. So there's a difference between the individual and then looking at society as a whole. You know, it's far be it from for me to make decisions about policy for everyone. I think that those are important conversations to be had with politicians. But in terms of the one-on-one with patients, I think first you have to have not every patient who has alcohol-related liver disease suffers from substance use disorder. A lot of times it's just a social thing that they do, and it's above what's safe for them. I don't want to stigmatize people who have this condition. And I think my experience is that the stigma actually worsens the condition, because a lot of people will not come forward with their symptoms or with their illness, or they think, if I go to the doctor, they're just going to tell me again I shouldn't be drinking, and they're going to judge me. I mean, I've had patients who've had very negative experiences in healthcare related to their drinking and being stigmatized. So when I see patients who have alcohol-related liver disease, I create a safe space for us to be able to talk about what's going on, what amount of alcohol they've been drinking honestly, do they think they have a substance use disorder or do they not. I try to remove all the stigmas that can prevent us from actually doing what's best for them and talking about their health in an honest way. And I hope that, that your listeners will take that to heart, that, it's not a disease that we should be stigmatizing. It's a disease that's very common, and that there, by the grace of God, go on. And that, a lot of us are consuming amounts of alcohol that probably would cause liver damage in someone else. And the fact that they're more susceptible says nothing about their character or who they are. Mm-hmm. They're just suffering from an illness like anyone else.
Mary in Rochester, I'm going to grab your call in a second, but let me just ask our other guests a little bit about this. Dr. Mathis, I was actually at a small dinner party last night, and I was having a small glass of wine, and I realized I was the only person with a glass of wine. And the other guests explained that they had their own reasons, and they were very upfront. And I immediately asked, hey, I don't need to have a glass of wine. It's not a problem at all. Because my experience has been people are pretty varied on this, especially people in recovery. Some prefer that those around them, if possible, don't drink. Others say, you do you, I'm fine. Like, I've got a plan, and I'm happy going about my plan my way. All the people last night told me, no worries, have your glass of rosé, we're all good here. But generally, do you find it's valuable for us to be sensitive to that, for those of us around us who are either, whether they're dealing with liver disease, alcoholism, recovery, et cetera, to be sort of sensitive to what people need in terms of drinks in social settings?
That's a great question, and I think it's always helpful when you have friends who are willing to be sensitive to your needs in social settings. What I tell my patients is to, as some of your friends and those who are you were with said, to have a plan. Because of the availability and easy access to alcohol, it will always be presented to them, right? And so if you're going out and there's a possibility that those around you may have a drink, what is your plan? And it depends on the level of relationship. Some folks may not feel comfortable revealing that they have challenges with alcohol consumption, and so they don't want to cause any disruption. Others have come to a place where they're willing and open about having that conversation, and it doesn't include additional shame. So we always say, have a plan. Know what you feel comfortable with sharing and what you don't feel comfortable with sharing. If you're not going to share that you're in recovery, and if you would prefer to not be around individuals who are having alcohol, then what other social settings can you engage in where you wouldn't be put in that position?
Mm-hmm. Sean, how is it for you in those kind of settings?
I'm actually pretty good with it because I am very open about everything. Obviously, I'm on, the show right now talking about it. So
sure.
So for me, it's pretty easy. But with a lot of my friends or clients who are going through, who are in a similar situation, they have bigger struggles with the shame and whatnot of it. And shame is probably one of the top barriers to help and treatment in the first place. So being able to be open with people about, about your substance use past or how you feel about it now, et cetera, is important, but it's hard to get to that point for a lot of people. So, yeah, having a plan is a good thing. I personally have, you know, tell everybody around me, do whatever you want because I'm good. You know, mm-hmm. I know that I don't want it and I can't, even if I did.
Sure.
So.
Sure. Very good. All right. Let me get back to some phone calls and some feedback from listeners. This is Mary next. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, you know, what I've noticed is that a lot of young women are into mid-century modern. And mid-century modern, there's always a bar cart. And that seems to be the big thing. Like, if you watch HGTV, oh, you got to have that bar cart. There's got to be lots of alcohol to make cocktails. And cocktails are really, you know, that's not a glass of wine. That's not having a bottle of wine in there for your dinner party. That's like an every night thing. You're making cocktails for yourself. But it's, I think it's become something that young people, when they set up house, they're doing that now.
Yeah. So, Mary, thanks. I mean, the bar carts, you're right, are very popular, and some are very snazzy, very cool. But I would say just because someone's got a bar cart doesn't mean they're going to make cocktails every night. Cocktails is usually some work to make. And not every cocktail is the same amount of alcohol. I mean, don't make the assumption that a cocktail is a double glass of wine or a double beer. There's some pretty light alcohol cocktails, and you can tweak that to your comfort and your setting. I mean, I like making cocktails once in a while, and I have no problem with friends who say, I'd rather have a Shirley Temple, or I'd rather have something that's really light, or really, like I said, I don't really drink heavy stuff anyway, the older I get. And so you can really tweak that and you can play with it. And that's one of the beauties of cocktails, is you can decide and you can invent. I've got lots of weirdly named cocktails, and most are really low alcohol. Anyway, is that you, Sean? Go ahead.
Yeah, I actually, like I said, I was in the service industry at running beverage programs in, for about 20 years. Most of that was in Chicago up until the last couple of years. And the, you know, obviously the craft cocktail scene there is huge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I will say in Chicago, at least, there is a heavy population of women that are running these programs and creating cocktails. So it's not just in, like I know what the guest is saying with the, you know, the cocktail carts and
sure,
stuff like
sure.
that, but it's actually in the whole service industry as a whole, where not only, you know, it's always been accepted to be drinking or using substances, et cetera. But at the same time, like women are actually, I mean, they're leaders and pioneers in that field. Of being, mixologists, if, you know, I never liked that term, but that's just me. creating these beverage programs. And, I think it is beyond like, you know, socially acceptable, and it should be, you know, for women to be, part of that scene and leading it, you know what I mean? But, the cocktail cart is one thing, but I mean, also when it comes to cocktails, I don't know, when I used to design them for my bars, they were pretty heavy hitters. You know what I mean? Like you'd have one or two lighter ones on the list, but out of 10,
sure.
eight of them would
Manhattans.
Be
oh yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. A lot of whiskey based and yep.
You got it.
It can be really, you're right. And that can add up fast. But it doesn't have to be that way. Mocktails can be awesome. I've got a friend.
Yeah.
I've got a friend who's a wonderful cocktail maker, and one of my favorite things he's made in months doesn't have a drop of alcohol in it. It's lime based, and it is beautiful. And I'm going, this is all we need. It's so good. So mm-hmm. So be creative. But I really appreciate Mary's point there too. I know there's some social pressure. Let me read a couple more quick ones here. Melanie says, there was a great podcast that addresses women and increased alcohol consumption and addiction this week. It is called We Can Do Hard Things. It's Glennon Doyle, who is Abby Wambach's wife, and her sister discussing their experiences. Thank you for the recommendation. And Dr. Laria, a quick question from Michael, who says, the anti-smoking ads for years told viewers the benefits on your body after giving up smoking for certain periods of time, the impact on your lungs, etc. I've never heard the same thing for the benefits of giving up drinking on your body after certain time periods, like a week, a month, a year, several years. Is there anything equivalent, Dr. Laria? We got about a minute left here. When you compare smoking, is there an equivalence?
I'll try to be extremely brief. I mean, from a liver perspective, we know that, you know, the acute effects of alcohol will wane within about 6 months. And then depending on if you have scar tissue left in your liver or not, if there's a lot of scar tissue, there might be chronic health issues related to that, but they should not be progressive. In terms of all the other concerns about alcohol, we know that the nerve damage, cognitive impairment seems to be permanent, although there is some improvement after stopping. And then they're looking into, in terms of cancer risk, when you stop drinking, if your cancer risk recovers, and that's, I don't think that that's clear. There might be literature out there I'm not aware of. But from a liver perspective, within 6 months, we can clarify at least the benefits related to stopping drinking.
I am so grateful for what our guests have brought to us on this Friday afternoon. Dr. Marie Laria is an associate professor in the Department of Medicine, Gastroenterology, Hepatology, the Department of Surgery and Transplant, and Associate Chair of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in the Department of Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Laria, thank you for the expertise. Wonderful stuff this hour.
My pleasure, anytime.
Such wonderful help from Dr. Myra Mathis, a senior instructor in the Department of Psychiatry, Addiction Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Mathis, thank you so much for the help.
Thank you for having me.
And Sean Yantz, a certified peer recovery advocate, certified addictions recovery coach, and a man who's learned a lot and shared a lot of really helpful stuff with our listeners. I am grateful that you came on the program to do that. Thank you, Sean.
No problem. Thanks a lot, Evan.
And our thanks to all the listeners for being with our whole team here, including Emma Ray Stein, Rob Braden, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson. Our thanks to Barsook Records for the music. And again, thanks for listening. We're back with you Monday on member-supported public radio.